Greetings. This is The Naturalist, Carol Butler
and Bernie Wise. And Carol has brought her zoo with her today.
All right. Anybody know what that is? That's an Eastern screech owl.
Great.
Sorry for this dead air. Okay. Oh, that's nice. That's a barred owl.
Mm-hmm.
I hope you can hear that. One more. This is a great gray owl. Okay, enough playing.
Okay, that's good. We have this new nice little, what do we call it, a wand or something? What would you call it?
It's making some, it's still making, you hear it? Okay, this is, I did a book signing on Saturday at a fabulous place called Wild Birds Unlimited in Paramus, New Jersey. It's a chain. There are, I think, 270 or 271 stores with that name. But this one is run by a fellow named Scott Gunther, and it is just the most fabulous place. It has everything you would ever need for feeding birds and studying birds, butterfly kits, bat houses, as well as all kinds of, we call them tchotchkes, little glass doodads and sculptures. And he's got a whole collection of salt and pepper shakers that are wonderful.
Right.
But mostly it's stuff for feeding animals and observing. Wonderful, wonderful binoculars and tremendous collection of books, including all of my books. And lovely, lovely people, and a wonderful dog that's very friendly and sweet.
Oh, that's good. Did you get the you don't have the dog recording, though. You just have birds in that book?
No. So I was signing books, and I was sitting near this gizmo, which is a bird song. It's called Flyer. And it's a bird song scanning wand, and it's the ultimate in bird song, because Bernie has taken me birding and said he's not good on the sounds.
Yeah.
And this has a little book and a little thing bigger, like a big fat pen that you hold in your hand. It has pictures of all the birds, and if you see a bird and you'd want to identify it and know what its song is like, you just scan, run the wand across the barcode in the book, and it gives you the sound of the bird. And
yeah,
you can also call birds with it.
That's good. That calling birds is good.
Right.
It's a good way to get them closer to you.
Right.
And you know, it's a barcode scanner.
That's
what
all
it
is. Right.
Like you go in the supermarket, then they scan your, you know, your Pepsi Cola or whatever it is, and just does the same thing. But what's nice is it's this little booklet of pictures of birds with the barcode right under them. So if you're out in the field, you don't have to schlep a lot of stuff along.
Right. It's
nice.
Very small, but it has a lot of birds in it. So hopefully it will work, and Bernie will have a good time with it. So I have a... Thank you. I have a bunch of little bits and pieces to talk about today, which are kind of interesting. If you look on the website for the program, I found this magnificent photograph of a katydid. And so I have to talk about katydids. The one on the website is a peacock katydid, and there are many other species, of course. And I have a photograph of one that's just on the leaves, and it's just camouflaged. And then I have this fabulous photograph that was on the cover of the Xerces
magazine right?
of the... katydid displaying with its wings up. It's just, it looks like it's got eggs on its wings. I don't know what the heck this is, because I just discovered this, and I don't know much about katydids except this particular topic, which is reproduction, which, you know, I'm interested
in. You know what family they're in? I mean, they look something like grasshoppers with wings or something.
Tetragonia. They're also called bush crickets.
Oh,
and,
crickets.
And
okay.
And the order Orthoptera.
Mm-hmm.
They're related to crickets and grasshoppers.
Right.
But they differ from them mainly because katydids make sounds. But they make sounds by rubbing the base of the left wing against the right wing.
Mm-hmm.
Crickets also make noises, but they do it in a different way. And grasshoppers also sing, but they rub their legs together, or they rub their legs against their wings or the abdomen.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing about katydids is that their song can be extremely loud.
For a size instrument.
Sometimes it's very high frequency, so we don't hear everything, but it's really...
How big are they, Carol? Like 3 or 4
they
inches
range,
or 2 inches?
Again, they range tremendously because there are so many different species. Mm. The general idea, we think of a green sort of leaf-like animal, but all over the world they have evolved into all different sizes and shapes. In Southern Africa, which Bernie talked about on an earlier program, there are giant predatory katydids that have muscular spiny legs to catch cicadas and beetles. In Costa Rica, there are rhinoceros katydids that prey on snails and lizards. And in Australia, where they have wild animals and of all kinds, wild meaning unusual because the isolated habitat, they have pollen-feeding katydids, which is interesting, extracting nectar and pollen. And in Tibet, they have a black katydid that lives 16,000 feet in the air on the ice in the Himalayas.
Wow, that's pretty wild. They must do a lot of meditation, though.
I imagine
those guys,
so.
You know, in this cold weather and up there.
So it's a huge family. But what I found very interesting, you know, I'm interested in animal reproduction. And they have a wonderful article in this Circe's magazine about katydids. And what I was interested in is how they reproduce. So I'm going to just talk about that. In this particular, I don't know which, we're talking about a particular species here. I think this is a spotted sylvan katydid that we're talking about. The male stops singing, lifts his body high above the surface of the palm leaf that he stands on. And his body shifts almost imperceptibly towards the female. She's attracted by the loud calls, the high-frequency calls that the male makes during the nighttime. So he lured a female. And she's interested, but she's not ready to mate. And we know this from the butterflies. You see that there's a great deal of courtship.
Right, a lot of courtship.
A lot of coming and going and changing their minds and withdrawing. And this is the same with katydids. Now, he's used up a lot of energy calling. And he's exposed himself to a lot of danger by revealing his location to the entire world in order to lure a female. So this is really a test to determine whether his genes will be passed on or not, because he's put out so much energy attracting this female. Katydid males are often likely to reject the female, even though he's knocked himself out to attract her. He may reject her because his investment in his offspring is nearly as significant as that of the female, which is different than in most species.
Yeah, usually it's just sperm.
It's just
a little nourishment.
It's nourishment, and the more females the male fertilizes, the more likely his genes are to be passed on.
Right.
With katydids, it's different, which is what's interesting. And so he's got a big investment in the female. If he attracts a female who seems too small or too weak to be a good mother, she will be rejected.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's, again, we think about the butterflies who will mate, some of them will mate with a female while she's coming out of the pupa. So forget about evaluating her reproductive capacity.
Get them young.
She's a female, get her right away. Okay, so on the leaf, the female spotted sylvan katydid, she extends her long antenna towards those of the male, and for a few minutes they sense each other with their antennas. And suddenly, the male forcefully shakes his entire body, which sends low-frequency waves through the leaf towards the female. She responds the same way, and for a while, they continue to exchange these short, silent vibrations. And this is a way for him to evaluate her size and strength.
You mean if she has the right vibrations?
That's right. Talk about good vibrations,
good vibes.
Right?
That's where that expression came from,
that's
good vibes.
That's probably right.
From the old katydid days.
That's right. So then she approaches. Now she's caught up in this, and she approaches, and he lowers his body and slides under her, grabbing the tip of her abdomen. He then secures her position on top of him by crossing his long hind legs over her back. And for the next few hours, they remain connected. And he produces a complex gelatinous structure, which he attaches to the base of her ovipositor, which is the organ through which she lays eggs, which is at the end of her abdomen.
So it's external fertilization?
Yeah. Mm. After they separate, she doubles up and begins eating this gelatinous structure that he has given her to give her strength and energy, right? And this is a nuptial gift known as spermatophylax, technically. And it's a big investment on the part of the male. And it's the reason why he's so choosy in selecting his partner, because he can't do this very frequently.
So it's a combination of sperm and nourishment in this packet?
Yeah.
And she eats it all?
Right.
Okay, now the sperm has to get to her ovaries.
Right.
Hmm.
But, you know, this is in the bed bug book that I'm working on, it's the same thing. Insects have an open circulatory system.
Right.
And so the male bed bug and the common bed bug and in many other species, they just inject the sperm into an opening in the abdomen, and it ultimately makes its way through the body fluid, the hemolymph, to the reproductive organs. So this is the same thing.
Even though
she swallows it, it ends up in the hemolymph and makes its way. You have to think about that. I mean, it's really, the organs are bathed in this fluid.
It's like our lymph system, I would think. Don't you? Hemolymph. That sounds like a combination of blood and lymph.
Right, and it's not really blood, because most of them don't have red blood cells. Right. But our lymph system, I think, is not floating freely around. I think it's in vessels where these are just open areas in the body that are bathed with this fluid.
It's the same as their blood supply too.
That's right. Well, that's the hemolymph. That's the body fluid.
Open circulatory system.
Open circulatory system. Yeah. Right. Hmm. So she gets this packet of carbohydrates and proteins, and they nourish her. And in some cases, the weight of this nuptial gift may exceed 20% of the male's body weight.
Wow.
So it's an enormous contribution to the fitness of his potential progeny. And it's been shown that a large nuptial gift significantly increases the body size and thus the survival potential of the offspring. Okay, so that's what was interesting to me. And I have some other species that was sort of similar stuff about the father's investment in the offspring. But here he really wears himself out, provides this carbohydrate supplement, which results in larger, healthier babies. And he also probably keeps the female busy eating it and removing it, with the hopes of reducing the chance of her mating with another male.
With somebody else, right.
Again, we know from butterflies, they mate for a prolonged period of time. Part of the time they're passing the sperm packet, which also has nutrients in it, but they also are keeping the female, when she's receptive, they're keeping her occupied so that she's not available to mate with another animal.
Mm-hmm.
Another male, not another animal.
Hmm. You think there's any chocolate in this packet?
Huh? It's carbohydrates, so you never know. Okay, so now I have sort of some related thing. I'm sort of talking about fathers and babies in this section. Okay, we'll do one quick one. In female butterflies, and we also know this about some birds. I remember this when I wrote about hummingbirds. I'm almost positive I'm correct about this. You probably know this. The female absorbs the eggs internally if there's no food.
Mm.
Instead of laying the eggs as a last resort, the female will absorb the eggs for her own
nutrition.
Right.
Yeah.
So they did an interesting study in pipefish, where the males brood the fertilized eggs in a brood pouch for several weeks.
Yeah, because the pipefish are related to seahorses.
Correct.
Same family.
And they also brood.
Same thing.
Right.
The male broods the offspring.
Right, okay.
In a pouch.
Right. I'm going to finish this section and then we'll take a break, Jack. It's short. It's known that in the pipefish, while they're brooding, there's a reduction in the number of embryos in the pouch during the brooding period. But the question is, who gets the nutrients from the embryos that are eliminated? And they did a study in Sweden where males were mated to two sets of females, one of which had radioactively labeled eggs and the other didn't, so that half the eggs in the brood pouch were labeled, right? And they studied what happened while the male was brooding them, and the amino acids were what were labeled. So they found that the amino acids in the embryos were transferred to the male, not to the progeny, not to the other embryos. So they were in the, they found the labeled amino acids in the male brood pouch and in his liver and muscle tissue. And no amino acids were absorbed by the other siblings. Hmm. So this is also shows for the first time that the males are taking the embryos, taking the nutrients from the embryos through the brood pouch, and it's what's interesting is these are all his embryos. Mm-hmm. So he's sort of reducing again. It's like what you talked about with the wildebeests, where you said there are thousands of them and they plunge into the water even if some of them drown. It's the overproduction of progeny, and again, you can afford to
lose a few,
or to take the nourishment, absorb some of them in the spirit of having the strong survive and right. eliminating some of the excessive numbers.
Yeah, well, in most invertebrates, they lay, or even some, well, mostly invertebrates too, they lay so many eggs.
Right.
So at least one or two will survive. You know, crabs lay thousands of eggs.
Exactly. It's the same principle.
And fish, same thing.
Right, same principle. Now, I don't know, so you gave me a signal that said 1 minute, but I'm okay.
He said, keep going.
Keep going. Okay, good. Because I want to do one more section, and then we'll take a break.
Okay.
This is also on fathers and babies. And this is about filial cannibalism, which is adults eating the young of their own species. And this occurs in many animals, not only insects, but in mammals as well. But the question in this study was, how can the male determine whether or not the offspring is his own? This filial cannibalism occurs in species where the parents also care for the offspring that they don't eat.
Mm-hmm.
So they're caretaking, and at the same time, they're cannibalizing the offspring.
Yeah, so the question is, how do they pick which ones to cannibalize?
That's right. How do they know?
Eat? Which one are the fittest?
So this study was done on male three-spined sticklebacks, which is a fish.
A little freshwater fish.
Right. Yeah. I looked at the photographs, but it really wasn't interesting looking, so I didn't put the photograph. It's a fish with little spines on the back.
They're about the size of Achilles.
Okay, so a couple of inches at the most.
Little fishies.
And filial cannibalism is common in spined sticklebacks. The males in this study were allowed to care for manipulated nests that contained different percentages of their own fertilized eggs. So they added eggs from other pairs that they had nothing to do with, and they studied them after 7 days. And they found that clutches containing a higher proportion of foreign eggs were more likely to be completely cannibalized than clutches where there was a lower proportion of foreign eggs, which strongly suggests that the males were able to tell that it was their egg strict. The male was able to evaluate their paternity strictly from cues in the egg.
That's pretty good.
Right? As he would take the egg in his mouth, I guess, or sense something about the egg. I don't know how much odor there could be or what he could sense. It must be taste.
Some chemical signal. It must be. Right?
Yeah.
Because all the eggs look the same.
Right. So he was able to, so that's interesting. I thought that's very interesting. Then there's some other variations about cannibalizing. Some cases, cannibalizing your own young puts the same evolutionary pressure on the eggs that a predator would, so that the faster the eggs develop, the greater their chances of survival. So, but the parent is putting that pressure themselves to encourage the speedier survival.
Yeah, I think that's fairly common.
Fairly common,
So only the the fastest developing ones are kept. Really.
That's right.
Even after birth.
That's right.
That, right. Like in bird nests.
That's right.
The strongest ones will survive and the others will be eaten or killed or pushed out of the nest.
Well, that's right. Well, with birds, it's also a way to root out offspring that are going to take too long to mature mm-hmm. and require too much parental care. With a lot of birds, again, I'm not a bird expert. I've studied a lot about only hummingbirds and birds of prey.
Yeah.
But they lay eggs. They'll lay an egg and then a couple of days later lay another one. They don't lay all the eggs at once. That's how birds are, I think, and pretty much in general. I'm generalizing from the tiny little hummingbirds to the big raptors, but that's, what can I tell you? And what happens is, so the offspring are all different ages, right? And very often the last ones to be hatched will become prey for the larger ones, especially with the raptors, unless the parents are bringing lots of food.
Yeah.
But if they're having difficulty finding prey to bring to the nest, then the younger ones, that the eggs that were laid later, will get eaten. The birds that have hatched out of the eggs that were laid later. It also saves the parents' energy for the faster developing young. So again, they may overproduce and later remove some of the inferior ones. Okay,
yeah.
I hear the music, so let's take a little break and we will be back. This is Carol Butler and
Bernie Wides,
the Naturalist Program. We are back with you.
And some more strategies for survival?
Well,
or is this something else, Carol?
I want to talk about animal emotion, which is very interesting.
Yeah.
But there's also some little thing that I noticed, which I'm going to talk about first. And that this is an article about in utero exposure to odors and how that affects the physical development of an animal. And they did a study on mice. But as a throwaway in the introduction to it, they say human babies and other young mammals prefer food odors and flavors of their mother's diet during pregnancy, as well as the mother's individually distinctive odor. Now, I didn't really know that that was true. Did you? We're both shrugging our shoulders.
In utero.
They say it. Just like, so it's part of a research project,
That's
so
amazing.
I guess it's true. We joke about when people are pregnant, you're eating this spicy food, it'll be too spicy for the baby. But evidently there's been research, which I didn't have time to check, because it said, like it's a given, that human babies prefer food odors and flavors of their mother's diet during pregnancy. Okay, as well as the mother's distinctive odor, I can understand.
Wait, odor too? I mean, smells.
Odors and flavors.
Are they doing this in utero or after they're born, these kids, and they're preferring what the mother ate?
They're
as
saying
their
the
diet.
Mother's diet during pregnancy. This is about human babies. So there you go. So, and this is also true of newborn mice, which is what they did the research on, that they prefer the odors, and they prefer the odors of closely related lactating females, even if they are unfamiliar. So they can tell somebody who's from their from their clan. Yeah. But that we can understand.
Sure, that we can understand.
They're
breathing and smelling. So, and I'm sure their own mother has a distinctive smell, like other animals.
That's right.
The way they identify their parents.
But even a relative of the mother who they haven't met before, they can identify her as family.
But that in utero thing, I have a hard time.
I know.
With that.
So now here's the research with mice, which explains it in terms of mice, and maybe the same with human babies. Mice were exposed during gestation, so in the amniotic fluid, right? And while they're nursing in the mother's milk, to odorants that were tagged, so that activate certain olfactory receptors in the brain. So you can do that. You can put a chemical tag or some kind of
radioactive
tag on the odorant that connects to specific receptors that is picked up by certain receptors. Well, they're called glomeruli. Yes.
Okay.
Part of the sensory receptors in the brain. And what they found was the glomeruli are tufted cells. You know, you think about synapses and how signals are passed from along the nerve cells.
Right.
So the tufted cells are at the synapses. That's what transmits to the across the bridge of the synapse, right?
Electrical signal.
Right. So the glomeruli, I don't know why I can't say that right, in the olfactory bulb for the sensory receptors of those odors that were tagged specifically, the glomeruli were larger in mice exposed to these activating odors. So in other words, and naturally if they're larger, they can detect and discriminate these odors in the future. And so it sort of follows that they're preferred, because they're more highly sensitive, because they have bigger receptors to these odors. It's really amazing. So it facilitates the selection of palatable foods, right, as well as kin recognition.
Right.
So the significance of the food, of conveying the food preferences from the mother, it teaches the offspring what is palatable.
Yeah, what's safe to eat and what isn't.
It conveys an instinctive appreciation of what's palatable and what's not. So it gives them a good start, anyway, on what to eat. So that's pretty interesting.
Yeah, I'd have to think that over.
Well, I mean, but it says that, I imagine with human babies, it's probably the same thing.
Sure.
That you're developing a sensory appreciation of certain flavors that you've been exposed to very, very early on.
I can almost understand tastes, but odors?
Well, it's very related. Think about a butterfly, right?
Mm-hmm.
When they stomp on a leaf,
right,
to tell whether it's correct for their babies, whether it's a good host plant or not, they're getting a whole chemical bouquet.
Right.
It's so that the question of is it taste or is it smell is very muddy, because it's a sensory receptor that is responding to chemicals. I think of it as sort of the same way, so that the
okay, just chemicals. So we, all right.
It's a chemical stimulation.
I mean, the thing that still is bothering me is this in utero stuff.
I know.
I
know.
That I'm sure the baby is developing its sense, its taste sense, and its smell sense and all that.
Right.
But if there's no wafting of smells, it's in the fluid.
It's a sensory stimulation by the fluid in the mother's milk,
right,
and in the amniotic fluid, so that it reaches the sensory cells and stimulates them to be to grow larger.
Right.
Pretty intense stuff, right? All right. So the last little piece that I'm going to try to squeeze in is about animal emotion. There's a lot of research about this. About we know that animals have distinct behavioral qualities that remain over time. You've ever had a pet or a cat or a dog, you know, you say, oh, my cat is very friendly, or my cat is very shy, but she'll come out after a while once she sees that you're quiet, right? And people interpret the moods of their pets, but there's very little scientific evidence of animal moods. It's difficult to provide, other than this kind of subjective observational stuff.
Yeah, Carol, you know, in our brain exhibit that we walked through very quickly, there's a section on animal emotions.
Okay.
By studying faces of monkeys.
Okay.
So there is research on that.
There is research, yeah, right, yes. Yeah. I put the... But you see, it's the the question is, what does the face mean?
Interpret the emotion.
Right. I put some dog faces on the page for the program to just show
some
other images, right. And they suggest emotions. But how do you know that's what the emotion is?
Right.
So they try to study this. They use the model that tries to correlate mood to decision making. So, for an example, an animal that hears a posture in the forest and adopts a safety first posture that would be characterized as feeling pessimistic. This is the language they
pessimistic.
Use.
Pessimistic.
I like that. And an animal that interprets that rustle as a sign of prey.
Danger.
Danger
prey.
Would be pessimistic. Prey, means
right.
we eat.
Right.
So that's an optimistic type of animal. So you can't really, you have to be careful not to be anthropomorphic and call
that's
it
right.
personality.
And we don't tag them.
So
with frustration and things
right.
like that.
So we call them behavior patterns that in humans are characterized as personality, but in animals you can only call them behavior patterns. You can't really assess the conscious experience of emotion in an animal directly, but you can measure neural, behavioral, and physiological indicators, which is what they do in these studies, which I'm sure is the same as in the brain exhibit. You should go to that brain exhibit in the Museum of Natural History. It's wonderful. Okay, so in early studies, earlier studies looked at how animals respond to situations that introduce discrete emotional states, mostly fear, fear or anxiety, right? And the discrete emotional theory argues that the core affect, the type of affect that the animal has, emerges as a distillation of the impact of the specific emotion. So if they're frightened a lot, they become frightened type animals. Mm. That becomes their behavior pattern. Lots of experiences of a discrete emotion may function to prioritize actions and influence decision making.
So it becomes a pattern.
It becomes a pattern, and then it influences their decision making. I'm hearing all kinds of noises through these earphones. I don't know what that is.
No, I think it's outside of the earphones.
You think it's outside? Okay.
From the restaurant, yeah.
Then there are also dimensional approaches that conceptualize emotions in broader terms. Okay. So that ongoing core mood states, positivity versus negativity, this kind of pessimism, optimism, approach avoidance behavior, are combined with an evaluation of the environment, of the current conditions. So no matter what your mood state is, if there's plenty of food around, you're going to develop one way. If you have a certain mood state, but there's suddenly a scarcity, there's a drought, or there's a flood, and your food source is gone, it will affect your mood. It'll affect your development. So this is a subjective state that is generated by the current. It's combined with the current context. Right.
Mm-hmm. If it repeats enough, it becomes a pattern.
Right. So it can sort of go either way. Either the core affect can develop from the discrete emotional state, or from the dimensional approach. It's sort of bidirectional. In that long term mood states can arise from discrete emotions, or they can influence discrete emotions. Okay, so now we have a study with wild caught blue tits, and I did put a picture of them because they're cute.
They're birds.
Yeah, birds. I put it on the page so you see it. They were typed as individuals were typed as having fear of novelty versus a willingness to explore their surroundings. And I like this experiment. These were wild caught birds. So they were put in cages, and a dish of their favorite food was put in the cage, but in the dish was also placed a bright pink plastic frog. And the question was, what do they do? If you think about it, I used to have birds, so I'm picturing my birds. I guess each bird was in an individual cage. At first they were agitated, which is what birds do if you do anything different around them, jumping up and down, hopping around in the cages. But some start feeding within seconds. not really put off by this bright pink plastic frog, right? And others keep their distance for several minutes until they finally much more cautiously approach the food. So they were characterized, this was done a number of times, and they were characterized by their, let's say, their behavior patterns when they were, when something strange was introduced. And the question is this just a laboratory phenomenon? So they purposely did this. These were, usually they do these things with laboratory animals, but these are wild-caught birds, and they were released into the wild, and their behavior was monitored. Excuse me. And that what was done was at the... I'm going to have a drink.
Yeah, there's something in the air here today again.
Coal dust.
Maybe it's coal dust, right?
We have a new cold coal
right,
stove.
A nice coal stove,
which is
this
beautiful
edition.
And very toasty in the outdoor room that has now been enclosed. But I think we have, there was a little dust released when they were cleaning it. But Roberta's restaurant is still wonderful, so come anyway. Okay, so basically, when these birds were out in the wild, they changed things at the feeding stations. They changed the color of the bowls, and they put new bird feeders in different locations. And lo and behold, they found that the behavior of the individual birds in the wild was consistent with their behavior in the laboratory. And there's other studies like that with geese, where they studied the boldness of geese. They put a scrap of carpet in a room that a geese that the geese were familiar with, and some of them were freaked out, and some of them went right over and pecked at the carpet. And they, when they follow up on that, they found that the bolder animals were the leaders.
Mm-hmm.
When geese fly, why would they? What happens? One animal flies, the others then fly and follow.
Somebody has to lead the V.
Somebody has to lead, right. Yeah. And they found that it's these bolder ones that are the leaders, which is, this is probably true. It's somebody finds the new food patch, right? Even no matter what the animal is, somebody reaches out and does that.
So it probably holds true across most animals.
I think
the more
certainly.
Bold or adventurous or those
right.
become the leaders.
It's like with people, right?
Yeah.
Some people are explorers. Yeah.
Sometimes they get knocked off, and then you have to find
the leader.
A leader.
That's yeah. But that's what happens. Somebody else emerges as the leader, in animal groups.
Yeah.
And then another wrinkle that applies to people as well. Okay, there are low information processors who don't pay much attention to their environment, like my ex-husband. And then there are very sensitive individuals who are always taking things in.
Right.
And taking things in can be good because information is valuable, but it can also be overwhelming.
Right. Those people could be paralyzed.
That's right.
You think fears about, and
you think
insecurity.
About highly anxious people who are exquisitely sensitive to what goes on around them. So these are all emotional variations. They also say, I'm going to end with one about pigs. Highly sensitive pigs squeal a lot.
They do. Mm-hmm.
So somehow that's a parallel with people as well, I think, with all the anxiety and
that's
the
a good way to wrap it up, Carol.
That anxious people do.
Well,
right?
They squeal and kvetch and complain.
Exactly, right.
So I don't know if we can say pigs kvetch, but probably.
Well, they complain. Yeah, I think it's anxiety.
It's
they
anxiety.
Do kvetch,
that's
right.
That's true.
Okay. So
that was a lot of interesting stuff at one
little
time.
Little bits
boy.
And pieces. But
I still have to check up on that in utero smells. But if you say they're chemicals, it could be liquids.
Yeah.
Liquid chemicals.
Chemical stimulation.
Amniotic fluid.
Right. It's
yeah,
really
so
pretty
that was good.
Interesting.
Okay, so we'll wrap it up for today, Carol.
Signing off, right. Thank you for having us on Heritage Radio Network. We have a good time every time we do this. And we'll see you next week for Carol Butler.
And Bernie Wise.
And signing off for The Naturalist.
Okay.